again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Van Gogh to Pollock, Modern Rebels, is on right now at the Milwaukee Art Museum. It runs through September 20th and includes 70 masterpieces from 68 of the most famous artists of the 20th century. Painting, sculpture by artists who shaped the course of modern art. 68 of those artists. It's drawn from the Albright Knox Art Gallery in Buffalo, New York. We'll ask our guest how this collection happened to be located in Buffalo, New York. And it's really one of the most respected collections of the 20th century art in the country. It includes a wide variety of artists: Van Gogh, Degas, Picasso, Chagall, Dali, George O'Keefe, Andy Warhol, Jason Pollock, and many, many others. Brady Roberts has been with us before, and he is with us again today to talk about this incredible collection. He is chief curator for the Milwaukee Art Museum. He's worked at other museums in this country and helped guide us, Scotty and KP and me, on a wonderful tour of this exhibit last week. It's always one of the highlights of our time here. Oh, we get to go to the art museum because it's so much fun. Hello, Brady. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for inviting me, Kathleen.
Yeah, it's such an amazing exhibit because it covers so much territory and so many different styles, doesn't it?
It does, and it's actually one of the most comprehensive exhibitions of modern art that you'll ever see. And it starts in the 1890s with a smattering of post-impressionism, but a beautiful smattering of Van Gogh and Gauguin and Pissarro. And then it launches right into just an amazing survey of 20th century art, beginning with School of Paris and going right through the pop art period.
Yeah. So how did this museum in Buffalo get all this art?
Well, you know, if you think of the history of the United States and the industrial cities in the 19th century, and you look at some of the great collections in the United States, like the Cleveland Art Museum, these were very prosperous cities, and they had major patrons, and they were looking to establish the cultural bona fides of their cities, and they built these great museums and collections, and Buffalo was an industrial power in the 19th century and the early 20th century, and they had many prosperous people, and they founded a museum in the 19th century. So
what did they do? Are they closed down for the summer, or how did we get all
these paintings? Well, the Albright Knox Gallery is doing what we're doing at the Milwaukee Art Museum. They're renovating their collection galleries, so their collection is off view right now, as is ours, and these are the highlights. These are the 70 best works from their modern art collection. And Dan Keegan and I went and visited the Albright Knox Gallery about 3.5 years ago, and we saw this exhibition. It started there, and we both knew the reputation of the museum and that they had so many of these key pieces, but we were just blown away by this show, and we left thinking we've got to have that show in Milwaukee.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really good. It even made me, I'm more of a fan of Van Gogh and Pissarro and Modigliani, and you have great pieces by them. But I found myself, I don't know if I've ever paid much attention to Pollock, and you've got this huge painting by Pollock that was pretty captivating. I looked at it for a long time.
Yeah, it's one of Jackson Pollock's best paintings, Convergence.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, he was really sort of a comet-like figure. You know, it took him a long time to develop this style, and then he burned through it very quickly. I mean, it was many years in the making, the invention of drip painting, and it was so significant because he was the first of that generation to really land on his mature style, to push through all the lessons of European modernism and create a new, more American style. And he sort of led the way for the rest of that generation. And Willem de Kooning famously said, Jackson broke the ice. And, you know, he showed them that they could be radical innovators. And they needed to be radical innovators. And they needed to get away from cubism, which was, you know, it was such an inspiration, but at the same time, it was a trap for that generation because they started copying Picasso's style. And then where do you go from there?
Right.
You know, and then surrealism became a tool that allowed every individual to tap into their subconscious, and that's where a lot of these styles developed from, including de Kooning, Pollock, and even Mark Rothko. If you look at his earlier paintings before he invented his signature color field style. He was playing around with surrealist figures that were in a background that looked like the paintings that we know today as great Rothkos.
Was it the Pollock that you were talking about that was so large it just fit in, or was it another painting?
The Pollock was a big one, but the real test was the Clifford Still painting, which cleared our elevator by 1 inch.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. It's a painting that's 12 feet tall and 18 feet wide. So it's a huge... It's a monumental canvas, and that's another really amazing thing about this exhibition. You walk through this beautiful European modernism presentation, and you're looking at gorgeous paintings, and you realize, you know, these are all easel paintings. They were made for people's homes. They were made for dealers to sell to people to put in their homes. And then you kind of walk around the corner into this abstract expressionist section, and it just opens up into cavernous space because we had to give these monumental paintings breathing room. And these artists were working in industrial studios, not little garrets like many of the French painters, School of Paris painters were. And they were creating for institutions. They were creating for galleries that were also in big industrial buildings, and also for museums. So they weren't making paintings for a living room. So it's a completely different feel. And it's also, there is a kind of rough, rugged quality to the abstract expressionists, where they were very consciously moving away from the higher degree of finish associated with European modernism.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Salvador Dali for a moment, because there is something, it's a beautiful painting by him. I normally wouldn't say this about Dali, but there's something about the, it's just, it doesn't even look like a painting in a way. And then I started reading in the catalog about Dali and Sigmund Freud, and I never knew that, and they met each other, and what Freud had to say about Dali, and whether or not Dali was using Freud's dream thoughts to paint his paintings or not. It was a great story.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting thing with Salvador Dali, because if you look at his painting, it's probably one of the few paintings in that exhibition that has a closer ties to academic tradition that goes back to the Renaissance.
Oh.
So it's actually, if you look at that painting stylistically, it's very much like a window, using the canvas as a window into space. So he creates a very convincing three-dimensional space. And stylistically, he's closer to old master painting techniques than to almost anybody else in that exhibition. And actually, for generations, art historians dismissed him because he was such a character, right? He was always presenting himself as this sort of mad genius artist in these very staged photographs and staged moments, and he was working very hard to associate himself with famous people like Sigmund Freud. And you know, he just sort of got dismissed as this, this sort of enfant terrible of the contemporary art world. And the other path of surrealism was based on what André Breton, who was the leading spokesman of surrealism, called pure psychic automatism. And it was essentially doodling, or letting your hand go free as a way of tapping into subconscious impulses. And that sort of led to very loose abstract drawing that art historians will draw a line right to Jackson Pollock and say that drip painting emanated from that branch of surrealism. So the abstract branch of surrealism for art historians was always considered the most important one, and Dali was sort of sent to the sidelines as this sort of character who was actually working in a retrograde style. But today, you know, we look at the painting, and it's an exquisite painting.
It is,
and
yes.
And he used that old master technique to bring a dream state into the real world.
Mm.
So if you look at that painting, it does unfold like a dream, where a landscape becomes a tabletop, where a mountain becomes a bowl, where another mountain becomes his wife floating through the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he did that over and over again. He really captured these beautiful dreamlike images in exquisite paintings. And now, you know, influence is always an important factor. How influential is an artist? So look at Dali today, and you look at so many representational artists, and not just in painting, but if you think of Matthew Barney, for instance, one of the great video artists and filmmakers of the 21st century, is like a continuation of Dali. You know, it's a very surreal language that he brings into the real world. So we recognize now that Dali was actually very influential, despite his outsized persona.
Yeah. And as much as I love seeing that and love seeing Pollock, and I want you to tell me why this is the case, the person I always go to if I have a chance to do it, and it's not often in my life, is Pissarro. I love Pissarro. I love who he paints. I love the way he does it. I love the fact that he put, you know, a principle behind his painting, and evidently didn't make a whole lot of money, but there's something so moving about his paintings to me. Why is that? Why does that affect me that way, and somebody else might look at the Dali or the Pollock and be affected the same way?
Well, Kathleen, I guess you're a romantic, because that's it's a very romantic painting. I mean, he's actually in the beautiful picture that's in this exhibition goes back to Millet and the sort of heroic workers in the field, you know, and this is related to Emile Zola and Germinal, and, you know, the sort of heroic presentation of the peasants. And so he's portraying these workers in a field in a very heroic way. But also stylistically, this is an exquisite painting. It's a very fine pointillism. And if you go up and examine this painting closely, you're rewarded with just an amazing palette of colors that pull together and blend optically from a distance. But it has a certain vibration in the way that Seurat paintings have a vibration, and that's what Pissarro was responding to at that time, was the invention of pointillism and Seurat's work. So it is really an exquisite canvas.
Mm-hmm. And Modigliani also, I'm not familiar with the vast body of Modigliani's work, but the painting of the servant, because he wanted to paint people like that who he thought were overlooked.
Yes, right. But it's interesting how he would use the subjects as a starting point for real invention, and he does the same thing to every person, which is he turns their head into an almond shape. The face becomes mask-like. The whole figure is elongated. The neck is attenuated in a way that maybe Nefertiti's neck is. You know, so it becomes the starting point for something that is semi-abstract. And then he's also very consistent in his sculptures in creating, you know, more geometric sort of forms that were also very elegant and very beautiful, but, you know, removed from representational art.
Mm-hmm. So for you, when you're in that exhibit, what pieces do you go to all the time when you're just by yourself?
You know, there are several touchstones, and I'm never in there by myself because there are always people in there, which is good. That's how we like it, and that's fine. But, you know, when you enter the gallery, the first painting you'll probably see is the Van Gogh, and it's a knockout. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's just from his best period. It's from 1888. Just a few years before he committed suicide, and it was the most prolific period in his career. It was the time when he was creating his best paintings, and there's so much energy in the brushwork, in the patterns of the landscape, in his choice of colors, and, you know, he was working so fast, he would take the paint right out of the tube and he wouldn't mix it frequently.
Oh, really?
And, you know, so it's just, it has the energy of his kind of psychic makeup. And I look at his paintings from this period, and it's like they're all self-portraits in a way, you know, because it's like this is a landscape through the filter of his imagination, and you can just feel the energy. It's palpable. And it's such a rich painting in all the variations of patterns and colors. And he took the most simple subject, an old mill and a landscape, and made it this absolutely exquisite composition. And, you know, who else could do that? So you can get hung up early on in this exhibition was just spending a lot of time with a few paintings. Another one is the Jean Miró painting of the Harlequin Carnival, which is so full of characters, this cast of characters, and there is this weird, surreal narrative thread to it. And the more time you spend with it, the more you understand it's like a stage with this surreal play going on. And you can spend a fair amount of time trying to decode it or construct that narrative. And it's really a wonderful work. And it's one that I remember studying as an art history student and thinking, wow, what a fascinating painting. So now to be able to spend time with it in the flesh is really incredible.
Yeah. And beautiful Gauguin, too, right?
Great
early
Gauguin.
On. Very beautiful.
I mean, another one that's just, you know, great example from his best period. It's a major work that's in many textbooks. And it's fascinating to see this work because he was at the height of his powers. But like Van Gogh, he was so poor at the time. I mean, he couldn't even afford canvas. That painting is painted on burlap.
Is it really?
Yeah,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and he did some of his best works were painted on burlap because he just didn't have artist materials.
So how do you go from, let's jump ahead towards some of the later paintings in the exhibit, to Andy Warhol? And I must say that I never thought I was a big fan of his, but I really like that soup painting. There's something about actually seeing it instead of seeing it in a magazine.
Yeah.
It makes all the difference.
Well, you know, what's great, what I love about this show is that you go from Pollock to Warhol. And what one of the things Pollock did is he invented this idea of an all-over composition. So instead of having a central figure or a main focal point, there's incident all over the canvas. So there's an equal amount of energy everywhere. It's an all-over composition. That became a sort of major compositional device. And Warhol, if you look at Warhol, you think this guy has absolutely nothing to do with Pollock. And in many ways, he did go the complete opposite direction. But he did understand that all-over composition. And you see the same thing in the Campbell soup can, because it's head to toe, it's all soup cans, and it's the same image repeated over and over again. So in that way, it is like a Pollock painting. But he drained his work completely of emotion and made it the other thing. He made it very banal, very everyday. And in fact, he was holding a mirror up to American society and saying, now in the post-war period, this has become such a prosperous country that this is really a country that is based on mass production and mass consumption. This is America.
Mm-hmm.
Campbell soup.
Now you're going to have to explain to me, because I have the catalog, and so I brought some of the paintings out for other members of the family to look at, too. I don't get, and forgive me, please, I have to admit this, but you can explain it to me. I don't get these paintings that are, I was looking at them in terms of what color should I paint our bedrooms in our living room, actually. But these paintings that are like this single gray, or it looks like a, you know, orange that's got some lines in the bottom, or
right.
What is that?
Well, each one, you know, the story of modern art are individuals inventing styles. So there is no one answer to that. But let me talk about two of the paintings that I think you just referenced.
Okay.
So let's start with the orange one with the blue lines. Okay. And I love that painting because it's I take people through, including art historians, and I say, don't look at the label. Who's that painting by? And it's a stumper. I mean, nobody can get it. So if you know the museum's collection, you'll remember a work that is a round plastic disc, a semicircle, that is attached to a wall, and it's illuminated by four lights, two at the floor level, two closer to the ceiling. And the effect that it has is it illuminates this plastic disc, and it creates four shadows. And the plastic disc sort of dissolves in the light, and the shadows become the sculpture. So this artist is one of the founders of the California Light and Space Movement. His name is Robert Irwin, and that's who painted that painting. So Robert Irwin was a frustrated abstract expressionist who was trying to dissolve the edge of color field painting through painterly technique. And he tried and tried and tried. And that painting is part of his trying and not succeeding. And it's a failure that led to a success.
Oh, fascinating.
And so his next step was to move away from painting and to use new materials. Plastic was, you know, very new. Vacuum form plastic was a new thing in the 1960s when he was using it. And so he did that, and it became the transition from him being a painter to an artist who uses light as his medium. So that was a stepping stone on the way. But those pieces are highly prized, and we're fortunate to have a beautiful one at the Milwaukee Art Museum that we'll see when we reopen our reinstallation, when we have our collection galleries back on view later this fall. So I think it's really interesting to see that connection with our collection. And actually, you know, if you go through that show, and if you particularly think of the Bradley Collection of Modern Art, there are probably 20 conversations with our collection in the Albright Knox show.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's nice.
So,
but on the other hand, there is one picture of the, and I can't remember the name of it, the different oranges, you know, which I thought was really beautiful. It was lighter, kind of orangish yellow, and then, you know which one I'm talking about? Rectangular piece, very large.
Well, there's the Rothko painting. Is that which one
maybe,
you're thinking?
I don't know.
Yeah, there's a Rothko that's orange and yellow.
Yes.
And it's really kind of a vibrating field of color. And it's interesting how connected to nature the abstract expressionists were. So, I mean, this the sort of blurry line between the squares of the Rothko painting look like the edge of the sun, which is called penumbra. So it has that vibrating glow to it. And Rothko Was born in Russia, and he was very steeped in the tradition of Russian icons and the idea of using gold leaf paint as a spiritual light. And this is a very abstract language about the same thing, about transcendence. So he's creating this big enveloping color field, this vibrating painting that you could lose yourself in, that you could feel this sense of transcendence.
Oh, well, he did that with that. That's all right. Now I get it.
Yeah, so there's one.
there we go.
So all let me, here's probably the most difficult painting in the exhibition is by Agnes Martin. And that's the one, it's like a white canvas with lines drawn on it, and it's a series of horizontal bands.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, and Agnes Martin, when people look at her paintings, they think she's a minimalist. And I met her when she lived in New Mexico, and she told me, everyone thinks I'm a minimalist, but I'm an abstract expressionist. And what she does is uses an abstract language to convey a philosophical idea. And she would get an ideal of perfection in her mind and try to recreate that on the canvas with a system. And her system, the grid or the horizontal bands, are hand-drawn. And because of that, they're never quite perfect. And that's her sort of understanding of how we try to attain but never do perfection in the world.
Fascinating. All right, we're going to welcome phone calls. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to see the exhibit, but you, of all the people we've talked about, you may want to talk about some of the artists who really move you for whatever reasons. We've looked at a lot of the paintings that are in this terrific exhibit, and we'll have to talk about Chagall, and we talked a lot about Dali. What do you think about Dali, the audience? I'm interested. Viard, we'll have to talk about him. We'll ask our guest to talk more about some of the abstract expressionists, the modernists. I've told you some of my favorite paintings because, what the heck, they were moving to me. And here's how you reach us. Brady Roberts is our guest. He is the chief curator for the Milwaukee Art Museum, and the exhibit, which is on now until September 20th, is Van Gogh to Pollock, and it's terrific. So join us if you'd like. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well. And that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're welcoming phone calls now for Brady. We're talking about the Van Gogh to Pollock exhibit, post-impressionism and cubism, surrealism, abstract expressionisms, and pop art, all in the same wonderful exhibit, Van Gogh to Pollock. And let's go to our first caller, Brady, Peter in Stoughton. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
My first experience with Clifford Still happened at the Albright Knox. One of the few benefits of living in Buffalo when I was having the Albright Knox there. And I'll always remember going into one particular gallery there and getting blasted by all that was in this relatively simple painting. The other comment that I had was I was at the Chicago Art Institute a few years ago, and looking at a small Dali that was there, I can't remember the title, and there was some light coming from outside off to the side. And if you looked at the painting head on, you saw what you were supposed to see, but this reflected light off to the side, if you looked at it at the painting at an angle, you could see that he had reused some canvas, because there were some other images hidden underneath the painting that you were seeing that were unrelated to the actual painting. And I thought it was kind of an interesting mystery, so to speak.
Hmm. And would you frequent the Albright Knox Gallery often?
Yes. It was so neat to have something like that in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that was affordable, and I was, well, I've always been into, not always, but for years I've been into more contemporary art, and their collection there has always been something to enjoy, and I'm really looking forward to making my way to Milwaukee and reminiscing on some old times and seeing some new things.
Oh, you're going to have a good time, Peter.
You know, it's interesting that you would single out Clifford Still because he was such an ornery character that he really didn't like to participate in the art world too much. So he didn't think much of dealers or even museums for that matter. And he kept most of his paintings to himself. And when he died, he had a will that said, you know, these paintings can only be showed at a Clifford Still Museum.
Really?
And any city that builds this museum and funds its operation can have this trove of hundreds of paintings. And it was decades before the before Denver built the Clifford Still Museum, which you can now go visit. But outside of Denver, there are very few places that you'll find any sort of selection of Clifford Still paintings. But the Albright Knox Gallery was so serious about collecting abstract expressionism that he did sell them works. So, but it's great that you singled that out. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but I love his paintings. I mean, they have a kind of really rough, bark-like quality, and he's just developed this abstract language of nature that's incredibly powerful.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Peter, for the call. I know you're going to have fun in Milwaukee. Email who said she saw a Salvador Dali exhibit in St. Petersburg, and a guide told her that Dali would sleep with pebbles in his hands so that they would eventually wake him up from sleep and he could remember his dreams. Is that true?
Oh, it sounds like a typical Dali sort of a tale. You know, he had lots of them, so sounds apocryphal would be my guess.
Yeah, I think it probably is. You have a Toulouse-Lautrec. I didn't realize that his parents were first cousins, which may have created some of his physical problems, huh?
Right. And the Lautrec painting in the exhibition, you know, it's in this early post-impressionist section, and it's one of the more monochromatic paintings, so it doesn't jump out at you, but it's a really wonderful, seedy kind of brothel scene that's just oozing with character, and it's classic Toulouse-Lautrec.
Yeah, and what other? How do you define who defined pop art? When did we get pop art? Who was the father or mother of pop art?
Yeah, and I think that term came from critics who said, you know, these artists are drawing from popular culture. We'll call it pop art, and it's a great moniker, and it stuck. And I wish I knew exactly where it came from, but that's typically how these things develop. It's just like abstract expressionism. A lot of people were trying to develop the label for those artists. There was the New York School, the Irascibles, etc., and finally abstract expressionism was the one that stuck.
And you've got Warhol. Do you have other pop artists?
There's a really great Roy Lichtenstein from 1964.
Mm-hmm.
We use it in a lot of our promotional material because it's just such a fabulous image. And the great thing about Lichtenstein, if you happen to see the retrospective at the Art Institute last summer, it's really a wonderful show. Lichtenstein was a very happy, upbeat guy. And when he started as a painter in the 50s, he tried to be an abstract expressionist, but he just didn't have the angst, you know? He wasn't riddled enough with anxiety to be a convincing abstract expressionist. And as soon as he shifted gears and started pulling from cartoon imagery, it just clicked, and his paintings were fantastic from then on. So this is a really great early example of his work.
Yeah. And the article in the book about the exhibit says that he was challenged by his son, who was looking at a Mickey Mouse cartoon or something, and said to his dad, I don't think you can draw like that. And he took up the challenge.
There you go. And it's interesting. If you look at this cartoon woman's face, it looks like a very simple painting at first blush, but the way her face is rendered is with printing dots, but they're not printed, they're hand-painted. And, you know, these artists are very consciously playing with this early on. Warhol with his silkscreen prints, drawing from advertising imagery, the Campbell Soup label, and Lichtenstein drawing from this cartoon and creating a painting that looks like it's a print.
Mm-hmm. Is there part of the exhibit that you have had to grow to love? Is there a time in art that, I mean, you have to know all of it and appreciate all of it, but what did you have to work at to appreciate?
For this exhibition, for me personally, I love it all, but it is interesting because I remember studying art history, like a lot of people. I got my first real passion for art, studying Renaissance art, and then that kind of led to, you sort of go sort of chronologically, and then you go to the 17th century Dutch paintings, it's hard not to love Vermeer and Rembrandt and Hals. And then once you get into late 19th century, then you're moving down the slippery slope of modernism. And I remember, I mean, who doesn't love Monet and Van Gogh and Seurat, the Impressionists, the Post-Impressionists? The hard part for me was, as a student, making the leap into Cubism, because then it's as much intellectual as it is aesthetic. And so it creates a sort of different challenge. And then when you get into the sort of conceptual basis of a lot of 20th century art, it really opens up new doors. But it really helps to understand the motivation of the artist, why they're creating what they're creating. And, you know, they're all inventing their own language. So, you become adept at sort of decoding this visual foreign language, if you will.
I think you're really good at that, at decoding what's in the picture. Certainly when you look at art that was created during the time of the Nazis or the time of World War One or World War Two, we've been on tours with you when you've been able to look at a picture and see things that I never would have seen, because you know your history and what these artists were giving us.
Thank you. And, you know, one of the really fun examples that is in this exhibition that draws from a show we did a year ago is the Kandinsky painting from 1913. And we reunited our painting from 1913, Fragment 1 for Composition 7, with Fragment 2 for Composition 7 from the Albright Knox Gallery. They were painted sequentially, and they're two of his most important paintings. And they're absolutely layered with symbolic meaning that is very dense and not intuitive, and it takes time to decode them and understand them. But we provide all that literature for people who want to go there.
And when you say somebody's important painting, can you say that of most artists, this is their most important painting? Are there other examples in this exhibit of an artist's most important painting?
I think it's something that art historians do, but it's a little bit of a moving target. And it's very interesting when you look at an artist like Marsden Hartley. I remember when I studied him, and that's been a long time ago since I was an art history student, he had one important period, and it was the Berlin period, where he was doing semi-abstract portraits of his lover. And art historians thought all the other periods were insignificant. And then over time, each one of his other periods became important, and now we realize his whole career was important. So it can be a little bit of a trap, but in this exhibition, I mean, having said that, there are these sort of singular moments in a artist's development, in their career, and there are just, a dozen paintings that are the knockout paintings by these artists, from Arshile Gorky to Miró to Gauguin to Pollock. I mean, they're just, the real showstopper paintings, and to have them all together at once, to be able to see them in person, is just such a rare opportunity.
Yeah. It is such a difference to see it in person, isn't it, Brady? It really is. Yeah, you do.
And, particularly the scale shift will really punch you in the gut when you look at the beauty of these European modernist paintings, and you go around the corner and you look at that Pollock painting. You know, if you're not a fan of Pollock, you probably haven't seen the works in person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's go to Cheryl in Conover. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, I know this particular artist might not be in your collection, and unfortunately I just got in my car and I heard you talking. I'd like to know what your feeling is about Edvard Munch from Norway, the famous Norwegian painter, Impressionist.
Yeah, he's Munch is a wonderful painter. He's of course famous for the painting The Scream, which he did in multiple iterations. It got a lot of press recently. One version in pastel sold for lots of money, which happens a lot in modern art these days. One version was stolen from a museum in Europe and returned, so Munch has gotten a lot of attention for these more sort of sensational aspects. But what most people don't know about Edvard Munch, who was Norwegian, was that he had a very long career, well into the 20th century, and he painted incredibly beautiful landscape paintings. So he didn't just paint this one famous image of this sort of human angst, this existential image of the screaming figure on the bridge in this sort of nightmarish landscape. He did paint with very high-key colors. He was an expressionist, but he created many beautiful lyrical paintings. And in his late career, he was very interested in film, and he actually made films.
Really?
So when we were working on the Kandinsky exhibition a year ago, that opened a year ago, I was working with my colleague Angela Lampa at the Pompidou, and she put together a late Munch show, and I went and saw it, and she opened it with a film footage where he actually shot a self-portrait in black and white film. And it's just fascinating to see the guy who made The Scream, you know, lived beyond 1890s when that painting was painted and actually filmed himself. So you know, he's a 20th century painter, too.
What do you think of him, Cheryl?
I love him. And the reason that I love him, I have The Scream above my desk in my office to remind me that you need to release your emotion. And then one of his most famous ones is The Mother and the Child by the Sick Bed.
Yeah, that's called the large death scene, and he, you know, he portrayed this really powerful image of his mother dying. And, you know, in the 19th century, a lot of people didn't die in a hospital. They died at home in their bed. And so, you know, he captures these really, you know, very emotionally powerful, you know, moments in a person's life, or in this case, the transition to death.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Cheryl, for your call. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Oh, good afternoon, Kathleen.
Hi, John.
Thank you, Speaker. I was looking through a Smithsonian magazine not too long ago, and there was a picture looking down, a photograph looking down the Grand Canal from one of the bridges. And I thought, well, that's pretty. It's very interesting. But then I read the caption, and it was actually a hyper-realistic painting. I forget the artist's name. It was a female artist. I don't remember her name. But I was wondering, how is hyper-realism looked at?
What is hyper-realism is
well,
my question.
I don't know the painting that you're talking about. There was, of course, very important movement, photorealism, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and artists like Chuck Close and Richard Estes, Robert Cottingham, Ralph Goings, creating paintings that really looked like photographs, you know, just super hyper-representational. And it was pretty short but important period of art making. There are a lot of artists who, you know, just embrace realism as the ultimate goal. And, you know, some of them have something to say and some don't. An early example, when you were talking about a canal, I was thinking of Canaletto, who was the famous painter of the Venetian canals. He was basically painting for, you know, for tourists who were on the grand tour of Europe. But, you know, these are greatly admired paintings today that you see in museums all over the world.
Thank you so much, John, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Frida Kahlo, she's there.
Yes, she is. And I love this painting. This is a surprise. This painting is one of the smaller paintings in the show, and it's absolutely captivating.
It is.
And it's riveting, and it grabs you from a distance. And she had a way of putting herself in the canvas that you feel her energy and her emotion. And, you know, she had this very difficult, in many ways tragic life, and she comes across in her self-portrait as being so composed and in control. And it's a stunning portrait and a great example of her work, because she loved Mexico, and this small painting is her in a jungle with her pet monkey and her traditional garb. It's rich with Mexican iconography. And then she's dyed her hair, which is in this very elaborate sort of traditional hairdo. She's dyed it green. And so she's funky. She's like a punk, you know. And it's a fascinating painting. But, I mean, she's just this kind of riveting persona.
And the monkey seems like her kid almost. The monkey's got his or her arm around her.
Yeah, and that she had a pet monkey, and that's her pet monkey.
She did have a pet monkey.
So that's all, you know, that's a real look at herself and and her, you know, in her environment, in her world.
Let's go to Susie in New Berlin. Hi, Susie.
Hello.
Hello.
I just wanted to mention that this is a great show for families that want to really see a lot of art that they might, the kids might have heard the names, the adults might have heard the names, and really be able to explore it with the whole family. And there's even a family day on July 19th, and there's lots and lots of activities that have to do, usually have to do with the show. So it's just a neat time to go. But I think it's a great show for a whole family, for kids, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you for that. And, you know, it's really fun. I love going into the Kohl's studio, which is right across from the Baker Roland Gallery. And one of the really cool projects they have for kids now is to make your own Pollock painting. And, you know, it's one of those things, like when you look at a photograph of a Pollock painting, it's the famous, oh, my kid could do that. Okay, well, let your kid make one. And it's really fun. But what you realize is it's actually really hard to do, to create a painting that's beautiful like that, not just make a mess out of those kind of skeins of paint that he so delicately applied.
And it is kind of an art history lesson, because you're moving through so many periods of art, you know, different movements.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, when we arrange an exhibition, there's usually a discussion early on about, is this going to be thematic or chronological? And this, the chronology is so solid in this exhibition, why would you do anything differently?
Right.
So it is walking through time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're also walking through history, and you can see that art had a certain look before World War I, and then it looked different after World War I. Mm-hmm. And then there was this epic change from Paris to New York with World War II. And then there's this response to mass production, mass consumption in the 1960s. So, I mean, these artists did not exist in a vacuum. And it's kind of like, the more you think about artists in society, the more you'll get out of this show. It's just operating on many different levels simultaneously. I mean, you can appreciate these works just for their pure aesthetic beauty, or you can think about, you know, how these were created during a certain place and time.
Exactly. And who the people were who created them, and what their life stories are, too, which
right.
I like. More phone calls in a moment. Thank you for the call, Susie. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking this hour about the Van Gogh to Pollock Modern Rebels exhibit, which is on now until September 20th. 70 masterpieces from 68 of very famous artists of the 20th century. We've been talking about many of them with Brady Roberts, who is the chief curator for the Milwaukee Art Museum. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Brady. Let's go to Michael in Madison. Hi, Michael.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon, guys. Great show. I can't wait to take my family, my daughter, over to Milwaukee and see it live. But I wanted to comment. I had heard once in an art history class that Salvador Dali had pulled up to a art opening in a Rolls Royce full of cabbages, and I was wondering if that was true or not. And I wanted to mention that I also got to, I studied sculpture at Iowa with Julius Schmidt, and was wondering if there's any of his work in the show, or I know there's a piece here in Madison of his, so I wanted to comment on that too.
Well, that's interesting. Okay. On the cabbage story, I cannot verify that, but it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, you know, you'd have to be quite a historian to know all of the stunts that he pulled, but that's one that, you know, is doable, and he very well might have done. It's great that you went to University of Iowa. My sister went to school there, and
so
I used
did
to.
I.
Okay,
yes.
So a lot of Hawkeyes here.
Yes,
and when you were there, they probably had the University of Iowa Museum of Art, which was flooded about a decade ago, and, mm-hmm. and right now is sort of out of business, and mm-hmm. I hope we'll come back someday. But they have an amazing collection, and it includes Jackson Pollock's mural, which is the prelude to drip painting. It's a work from 1944. It's on a monumental scale. Peggy Guggenheim commissioned it, and it really became the turning point for Jackson Pollock, and he began to crystallize his ideas for drip painting. But Peggy Guggenheim recognized that Pollock was basically a train wreck. I mean, he was drinking and fighting and distracted in Manhattan, and she set him up in a home in Long Island, and it's a beautiful environment. You can go and visit his home and his studio now. Yeah. It's like a little museum, and he painted in a barn. And the barn is like a chapel in a way, and they're actually drip painting's on the floor. They give you little booties, and you can walk on it.
Ah.
But the backyard looks like a Hudson River School landscape painting. It's this incredibly lyrical landscape with a stream running through the middle ground. It's just unbelievable. And you see how Pollock became in touch with the rhythms of nature and, you know, invented this more harmonious abstract style of painting. Mm. But University of Iowa was a special place to look at modern art, and I hope it will be again in the future.
Mm. Have fun in Milwaukee. I'm sure you will. Who is the other artist? I'm trying to remember of maybe an earlier one who died at the age of 35 who was had tubercular something. It's in my notes. Does this ring a bell with you?
No, it doesn't.
All right, I'll look it up. I'll look it up and see if I can find it. Let's go to Chuck in Duluth. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, great show. Hey, I was wondering what your guest there thinks of artists like Terry Redlin, primarily wildlife art.
I don't know the artist. You know, wildlife art is, you know, most museum people think of it as sort of illustrational, except if you talk to people at the Wildlife Museum in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and they're all about it. So, you know, this would be kind of the other end of the spectrum, where these are people who are not working in the same style. These are people who are inventing their own style. Wildlife art, by its very description, is about, you know, portraying scenes from nature. So it's not what we would consider avant-garde. That's not to say it's bad. It's just not avant-garde.
Right. Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Thanks very much for the call. So this will be here until September 20th. I'm always interested in, you talked about how you decided to arrange this. Is it done similarly at the Buffalo Museum?
Well, you know, their museum is very different. And when we went there, we saw it in an old Beaux-Arts building. So it was just a very different kind of feeling and look to their exhibition. our space is incredibly flexible. We have a 11,000 square foot column free space, Baker Rowland Gallery in the Quadracci Pavilion, this Calatrava design space. And our exhibition designer, David Russick, can turn it into anything. And for this exhibition, we kept it a white cube. There's very little stagecraft. There's very little theatrical design. We use some strong colors to indicate the demarcations between the pre-war and post-World War II period, and then to indicate the third period of pop art and beyond. But other than that, we kept it really clean and classical and pretty symmetrical, with a nice clear pathway guiding you through this. So it's not, we didn't want you to be thinking about the exhibition design. We wanted you to be experiencing the art.
Done it well. And what about your permanent exhibit? When do things
open again? It's interesting. We are right now taking possession of parts of the Kaler Building, the 1970s edition, which means our contractor, Hunsinger, who's doing an amazing job, is done with parts of the renovation, and they're turning it over to us, and we're in the process of moving art out of the Saarinen Building and into the Kaler Building, so that Hunsinger can now turn their attention to repairs and modifications in the Saarinen Building. And the quality of the work done in the Kaler Building is honestly beyond my expectations. So it is a complete transformation of the space, and is so beautiful.
Oh.
I mean, you will think that a new building was
built.
It's absolutely extraordinary. The East Addition, I would say, is still fairly abstract. It's not going to look like a finished building until the end, until we open in November. But the whole thing is just, it's really amazing, very exciting, and so much fun to be involved with this project.
And you must be very excited to have it open again.
We can't wait.
But you've done great in the meantime, because these exhibits have been good, and you've been drawing in a lot of people for this one, too.
Yeah, you know, summertime is so wonderful at the museum. I met some folks yesterday from Washington, D.C., and some folks from New York City who had never been to the Albright Knox, and I thought it was really fun that people from New York were coming to see the Albright Knox collection in Milwaukee. But it just, Milwaukee's a fun place to be because of Summerfest and, you know, so many people coming from the region and all over the country. And so we meet, you know, wonderful people at the museum, and it is a very vital place right now. So it's pretty nice.
And you really never get to just hang out there by yourself?
It doesn't happen, Kathleen. It's the truth. I mean, you know, they keep me cooped up in meetings a lot.
Oh,
that's
darn.
One thing. And then when
you got to get out of those
meetings.
When
I'm out and about, it's, you know, the public is there. But that's good. We want the public there, that we do this for them.
Yeah. Well, it's a terrific exhibit, and we love having you with us. And I can't find my notes
I'm trying to think. You know, Modigliani died young, and I don't know if
it must have been Modigliani.
Tuberculosis or the influenza epidemic, but he died very young. I think he was only in his 30s.
So that must be who it was. Yeah. That's who it was. Thank you. I won't have to worry about it now for the rest of the day. Brady Roberts, our guest this hour. We thank him so much for being with us and for giving us a great tour of this terrific exhibit. He's been chief curator at the Milwaukee Art Museum since 2009, and the exhibit is going to be there until September 20th, and well worth your time. It really, really is good. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks for on-air production from Scotty. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and we will be talking tomorrow. We told you about the second hour of the program, in which we will talk about declarations of independence and other kinds of declarations. First hour of the program, the director of a program aimed at ending mass incarceration, also the editor of a new book, Solutions, American Leaders Speak Out on Criminal Justice. So that's coming up tomorrow. And today marks my 22nd year of being at this place. Can you believe that? It's like I felt like it was 10 years. It's been 22 years. It goes by so fast, darn it, doesn't it? But it's been good. It's been good. Continues to be good. Thanks for listening. We'll be with you tomorrow.